My Tay Show tonight is dedicated to our founding teacher, Robert Aitken Roshi, and has been inspired by his essay called Dana, The Way to Begin. And just before when I came in, Janet gave us an accelerando on the Inkin, and we made our prostrations, which is raihai in Japanese. And it's a beautiful action when we lift our four arms off the cushion. And it's a move that throws everything away. Everything that we've been carrying with us. And we're right here in the sacred hall, taking refuge in the three treasures, practicing dana. The idea that dana means giving or relinquishing, and that it is the way to begin our practice, is found in the very earliest literature of Chan. A monk asked Hui Hai, "By what means can the gateway of our school be entered?" Hui Hai said, "By means of the dana paramita." The monk said, "According to the Buddha, the bodhisattva path comprises six paramitas. Why have you mentioned only the one? Please explain why this one alone provides sufficient means for us to enter." Hui Hai said, "Deluded people fail to understand that the other five all proceed from the dana paramita, and that by its practice all the others are fulfilled." "Why is it called the dana paramita?" the monk asked. Hui Hai said, "Dana means relinquishment." The monk asked, "Relinquishment of what?" Which is a very good question. Hui Hai said, "Relinquishment of the dualism of opposites," which means relinquishment of ideas as to the dual nature of good and bad, being and non-being, void and non-void, pure and impure, and so on and so on. A little bit about Hui Hai, who was in China in the 8th century. He was a pupil of great master Matsu, and he cared for the teacher in his old age. And while he was doing this, he produced a manuscript on sudden enlightenment, which Matsu read. Matsu said, "Here is a great pearl, the perfect and bright illumination which penetrates everywhere without impediment." And for this reason, Hui Hai became known as Ta Chu, great pearl. So when you come upon Ta Chu Hui Hai, that part of the name is great pearl, Ta Chu. His work was edited by Miao Xie and appeared as Tun Wu Ju Tao Yao Men Lun, in which the Southern School of Chan is integrated with the Mahayana Sutras. Now, you've probably heard tell of the Southern School of Enlightenment and the Gradual School of Enlightenment, the Southern School and the Northern School, and you perhaps wondered, like I do still, what does this mean? And I read recently the scholar Peter Hershock saying that the Chinese word used, which is Tun Wu, actually means readiness to awaken, as distinct from sudden realization, which makes a lot more sense, really. So Gautama then was Tun Wu as he sat under the pipala tree by the Nerinjari River, the Buddha tree, the Bodhi tree. We are Tun Wu too, as we sit here in Annandale in this dojo. Anyway, going back to his encounter with the monk, although Hui Hai does not include the dualism of self and other in his list of dichotomies which must be relinquished, it's clear he intends to, for he goes on to say, "By a single act of relinquishment, everything is relinquished. I exhort you students to practice the way of relinquishment and nothing else, for it brings to perfection not only the other five paramitas, but also myriads of other practices. This total relinquishment is the self forgotten, the fallen away, body and mind. So dana is not obligation, it is not sacrifice. I think it's an expression of gratitude, which is a word that's related to grace. It's the enjoyment of receiving as expressed in giving, a vivid mirror in which giving and receiving form a dynamic practice of interaction. Receiving too is a practice, somewhat difficult practice. The Japanese understand this, and their word for thank you, arigato, literally means I have difficulty. In other words, your kindness makes it hard for me to respond with equal grace. Arigato. I was staying with a friend at a friend's house recently and remarked on a very beautiful vase. Oh, she said, that was my Christmas present to my sister last year. She left it behind. She always does that. There are presents I've given her all through the house. It's not so funny. It's very sad. Why does she leave her presents behind? I was very curious. It's complicated, my friend said. She feels she doesn't deserve things. That if people knew what she was really like, how she sees herself, in other words, they would never bother to give her anything. So she leaves them behind. I asked, how do you feel about this? I ought to be used to it by now, she said. My sister suffers from depression. I keep giving her presents, but it hurts. It's as though when my gift for her is rejected, I'm being rejected. And I'm very moved by the willingness of my friend to keep giving in the face of rejection. This is dana in its fullness, without looking for gratitude, without even expecting gratitude, just giving time after time. The sensible thing perhaps would be to draw a line and stop. But who knows when things might turn out differently, when the gift might be accepted. Depression locks its sufferers within the prison of self, the dungeon of self-hatred, a state of mind far more intransigent than normal everyday self-centeredness, which is that when we look at our experience, we appear to be at the centre of the universe, that all experiences confirm our central place in life, and that every input is interpreted through the lens of self. Dogen said that the 10,000 things advance and confirm the self is realization. That the self advances and confirms the 10,000 things is delusion. So we hear a lot about the power of the ego and how, you know, the actual provisionality of this construct called ego, but we seem unable to shake off this ever-present sense of me. Many of us incorporate a gentler and kindler spiritual me in opposition to the worldly me, the troublemaking twin that needs a resolution, that creates, and this has this sort of sets up a divide and conquer sort of thing going on within us, pitting the spiritual ideals we have against our worldly reaction. So, you know, there's the Zen me, and then there's the shitty me, you know. In fact, somebody tonight said there's two me's. There are quite often two me's. When we relinquish the assumed reality of me by realizing what the me actually is, energy starts withdrawing from its perceptual fixations. And when we align with this non-existent me, the fact of this non-existent, really non-substantial thing, the path becomes much more simple, and things are seldom at odds with their opposites, and mostly actions have a place, an appropriate place and an appropriate time, and there's not much contradiction or there's not much even enhancing of what is already there. It's just plain. This is just how it is. Plain. But so when opening a gift this Christmas, it could be interesting to ask, how do I practice receiving? Do I ever feel the gift is not good enough? Or that I don't deserve the gift? What gifts do I leave behind? What is the need within me that can never be fully met by any gift at all? And when you are giving a present, to ask, What gifts do I withhold from giving? What are the barriers to complete giving and receiving? They're very interesting questions. Maybe you won't think about them at Christmas, but they are very interesting. This whole question of how do you receive a gift? What's your default position as a gift receiver? Do you like receiving gifts, or do you find it really, really awfully difficult? Why? These days, as you know, post offices sell tea towels and books and games, as well as stamps. And our tiny local post office is deep inside a chemist shop. So you go past all the chemist stuff and then you find the counter. And there's always a very long queue. So while I was waiting to collect a package recently, I thought, I saw a big plasticized poster for sale called 8 Gifts That Do Not Cost a Cent. I thought, oh, this could be good. So I jotted down the 8 gifts that do not cost a cent, and I'm going to thrill you with them tonight. They're quite good. Everything I'm going to read is on this poster. I haven't written any of this. The gift of listening, but you must really listen. No interrupting, no daydreaming, no planning your response, just listening. The gift of affection, be generous with appropriate hugs, kisses, pats on the back. The gift of laughter, share funny stories, cartoons and articles. The gift of a written note, it can be a simple thank you for the help note or a full sonnet. A brief handwritten note may be remembered for a lifetime and may even change a life. The gift of a compliment, a simple and sincere, you look great in red, or you did a super job, or that was a wonderful meal, can make someone's day. The gift of a favour. Every day, go out of your way to do something kind. The gift of solitude. There are times when we want nothing better than to be left alone. Be sensitive to those times and give the gift of solitude to others. The gift of a cheerful disposition. The easiest way to feel good is to extend a kind word to someone. Really, it's not that hard to say hello or thank you. That's the end of the list. And whoever wrote this list down may have read Thich Nhat Hanh. It sort of has a quality of... It's very familiar. I remember when he invited students to notice the smile on the Buddha's faces on all the statues that are everywhere, and to notice that the Buddha is not grim and not tense. He's not frowning. He's not grimacing. He's smiling gently, usually, always smiling gently. Sometimes it's not quite a smile, but it's not a grimace. And so Thich Nhat Hanh invited students and invite students to smile. It's a very radical thought. Smile. Even if we're not particularly happy. And I can remember one time when I was sitting with Thich Nhat Hanh and he said this, and there was a furious, furious reaction to this from several people who thought it was very hypocritical and they would never do it. If they didn't feel like smiling, they wouldn't smile. So, you know, he said, that's okay, don't smile. But I then remember he said, the latest scientific research shows that if you actually smile, this triggers all sorts of endorphins, you know, and actually the act of doing this makes a difference to how you feel. Well, I don't know. But... we can practice as if we're happy, you know. We don't have to wait to be happy. It's like Roshi always said, you don't have to wait to feel, you know, cosmic man before you do zazen. You just do zazen even if you're feeling really grumpy. You just don't have to wait for the right condition. You just, whatever condition you're in, you do zazen. That's it. That was the best advice I ever got about zazen. That's the same with smiling, perhaps, you know. When you smile, others smile. When you're sad, you know, if you're sad around, if people around you get sad. When you give, everyone gives. There's a marvellous dynamic that arises. By the way, the package I collected from the post office ended up being from Tova Green, and it was a gift to Tony and me on the occasion of Tova's 70th birthday. It's a lovely handmade book called Refresh. There it is. So sweet, with a little bit of bamboo binding down the side. And it's full of her watercolours and poetry. And it's a gift of Tova from Tova to her friends and family. Some of you might have been here when Tova was here talking about her hospice work in San Francisco. Anyway, I've known her quite a while. So, and here's how this book began. First poem, birthday gift. I made my friend a little book, folded from a single piece of paper with a poem by the nun Ringetsu, Early Summer Water. I promised to send a poem each month of her 57th year. My friend asked, "Will they be your poems?" "No," my immediate response. "I want to send you good poems." I caught, as did she, the self-deprecation in my words. Her question kept arising, "Will they be your poems?" Stretching me to become the poet I long to be. And out of that has arisen this little book. I just read another one of her poems, also about gifts, because this is what I'm talking about, really, gifts. Might have noticed. This is called Honey. I was sitting on the ground painting mounds of lavender bushes lining the green gulch garden path when Alan, the beekeeper, drove by in his white truck. He stopped. Alan and I became friends years before when I lived at Green Gulch. We exchanged homemade gifts, a Mikado poem about bees, photos of bees kissing peonies or dahlias. He'd give me honey or beeswax candles shaped like beehives or bears. Alan stepped out of his truck, reached into the back, and pulled out a small jar of clear golden honey. Silently, he placed it near my paint box, then drove away. I waved and kept on painting, grateful for his gifts, the honey and the warm regard that needs no words. Thank you, Tova. So, just remind us all and remind myself this person too, we have no need to wait for any type of realization experience, any kind at all. We can practice dana just as we are, as if it were perfected. Each of us with our own strange personalities and character traits, wearing our own clothes and eating our 21st century meals. We can practice dana in every single act. That's a challenge. Answering the phone, working out how to work the new iPhone, making your bed, tending the garden, catching the bus. Really, the will to practice, the will to relinquish the dualism of opposites and come back to the breath, come back to mu, that is the only requisite. So enjoy your practice and enjoy the gifts that you have, your unique self. Only one of a kind. It's never going to... There'll never be another one of us, you know? So it's incredible to think that, you know, we want to hide our light under a bushel, and like Tova said, my poems wouldn't be good enough. Give yourself. Take a leap. Thank you.